That means Russia says Syria's air defense has shot down 7 out of 8 missiles launched by Israeli warplanes during a Monday airstrike on Aleppo. South Korea registers a new daily record of infections from the coronavirus as the country grapples with a surge in the Delta variant of the disease. India reports nearly 4,000 new deaths from the coronavirus, the highest in a single day since June 12th. A top story for this half hour, newly revealed data shows Syria's air defenses shot down 7 out of 8 missiles launched by Israeli warplanes during a Monday airstrike on Aleppo province. According to the Russian military, 4 Israeli F-16 fighter jets targeted facilities southeast of Aleppo in the attack. The military said the Syrian anti-air units used Pantsir-S and Buk M-2 systems supplied by Russia. One missile damaged the building of a significant research center in Al-Safira region. Earlier, a Syrian military official also confirmed the country's air defenses shot down most of the missiles shot in the airstrike. Over the past years, Israel has carried out hundreds of attacks on Syria, leaving civilian casualties. At times, Damascus has repeatedly protested to the UN, condemning the attacks as a breach of its sovereignty. New reports reveal the names and titles of more than a dozen world leaders whose phones may have been compromised by the Israeli-made Pegasus spyware. French Daily Le Monde reported that President Emmanuel Macron and 15 members of his government were targeted for surveillance by Morocco's intelligence service. Morocco has denied any involvement. The Washington Post reported that the phone of Iraq's President Barham Saleh was also targeted. Kazakhstan's current president and prime minister, a circle of people close to the current president of Mexico, and both the king and prime minister of Morocco have been on a list of more than 50,000 people targeted by the spyware. Pegasus is also believed to have been used to target journalists and human rights activists. South Korea reports a daily record of nearly 1,800 coronavirus cases as the country is grappling with a new surge. The rise is driven by the Delta variant that makes up 40% of the cases. However, mortality rate remains significantly low, with an average of 2 daily deaths. One-third of the country's 52 million population has received one dose of a coronavirus vaccine. The government aims to vaccinate 70% by September. Elsewhere in India, the country has added over 42,000 new infections to its COVID-19 total. Some 4,000 more people have also died of the virus over the past 24 hours. India's infection tally stands at over 31 million, with an overall death toll of 418,000. Our correspondent Munawar Zaman says the rising number of COVID-19 cases in India is directly linked to the absence of public attention to health protocols.
Over the past 2 or 3 days, we're seeing numbers rising again. Well, there are lots of reasons behind that, but at the same time, the biggest state of Maharashtra is showing a greatest number of cases, because that is the financial capital of India, where people from all across the states come into work. Now, why is there a rise in number of cases is due to the fact that people always tend to relax after the wave is over. They don't follow the government protocols. They don't follow the guidelines. And they start getting back to the normal routine when even the prime minister and the government officials warned that this is not the end of the pandemic. This is despite the fact many people have been vaccinated. Some of them have received the first vaccination, while others have received both. And in many cases and in many instances, we have seen patients, we have seen people, despite receiving both the vaccination, they have got the COVID. The rural parts of the country are still reeling, Bardia. We always keep an eye on the urban hinterland. We have seen in the couple of months that bodies are being drowned to the rivers in Yamuna. At the same time, there were mass graves on the banks of Ganges.
The pandemic delayed Tokyo 2020 Olympics kickoff in Japan amid concerns about a rising number of infections in the city. The world's largest sporting event got underway with a softball game in Fukushima behind closed doors. The Tokyo Olympics, which will formally begin with Friday's opening ceremony, will be held largely without spectators to minimize the health risks. The Japanese capital is already under a state of emergency following a surge in coronavirus cases, 79 of those among people accredited for the Games. The World Health Organization chief backed the event, saying it's a celebration of hope amid the pandemic. However, he said the pandemic could be ended if G20 economies showed collective leadership.
Instead of being deployed widely to quell the pandemic on all fronts, they have been concentrated in the hands and arms of the lucky few, deployed to protect the world's most privileged people, including those at lowest risk of the severe disease, while the most vulnerable remain unprotected. More than 3.5 billion vaccine doses.
The WHO chief said out of more than 3.5 billion globally administered vaccine doses, 75% have been in just 10 countries. He said in low-income countries, only 1% of people have received at least one dose, compared with more than half of people in high-income countries. The coronavirus pandemic has so far killed more than 4 million people around the world. Australia's new COVID-19 cases keep surging despite restrictions that have affected over half of the country. New South Wales state reported 110 new cases after being into a lockdown to contain the Delta variant outbreak for nearly 4 weeks. Also, the state of emergency registered its biggest spike in the number of cases this month with 22 new infections. That's while it's been under a statewide lockdown for almost 2 weeks. Currently, over 13 million Australians are under stay-at-home orders. The country has so far reported a total of 32,000 cases and more than 900 deaths since the start of the pandemic. Several countries across the world celebrate Eid al-Adha, the Muslim feast of sacrifice, amid concerns over the spread of the coronavirus. Millions of people in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Thailand celebrated the event, some by performing the Eid prayers under health protocols. Similar celebrations were held in a number of cities across Iran on Tuesday. People across the occupied Palestinian territories, as well as countries like Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Egypt, celebrated the event, which marks the end of the Hajj pilgrimage. As part of the celebrations, Muslims visit friends and relatives too. Some also sacrifice animals and donate their meat as charity. The practice aims to honor Prophet Abraham for his willingness to sacrifice his son as an act of obedience to God's command. The annual Hajj pilgrimage, one of Islam's most special ceremonies, is underway in Saudi Arabia, but the country has limited the attendance of the pilgrims, allowing only Saudi citizens due to COVID-19 concerns. Iran's leader also delivered his message on the occasion of the Hajj pilgrimage. Here's a report.
Every year, millions of Muslim pilgrims descend on Mecca for the Hajj pilgrimage. It's a religious obligation on all Muslims who are healthy, financially able, of sound mind, and of age to perform the pilgrimage at least once in their lifetime. The Muslim pilgrimage traditionally begins in Mecca. The pilgrims start by tawaf, circling the Kaaba counterclockwise 7 times and walking between the hills of Safa and Marwa. Pilgrims then spend a day praying in the Valley of Mina before heading to Arafat, some 20 kilometers east of Mecca. They then stone 3 pillars in Mina in a symbolic gesture of stoning the devil the following day. After the stoning, an animal is sacrificed to mark the first day of Eid al-Adha, when Muslims commemorate the willingness of Prophet Abraham to make any sacrifice commanded to him by God. The pilgrims conclude Hajj by returning to Mecca for a final tawaf. Although not part of a Hajj itself, many people round off the pilgrimage with a visit to the holy city of Medina, where the Prophet is buried. However, this year, like the year before, Saudi officials have restricted the number of pilgrims to the holy sites.
So obviously, it's going to be a challenge because COVID is a real virus, and it's really affecting the whole world. people have died from this virus, and we've seen what happened in Iran and different countries as well as in Canada. So, you know, to have social distance is difficult when you're doing the pilgrimage. So that is obviously a problem as well, and it does have, you know, restrictions to how much people can maybe attend a Hajj. But at the same time, the Saudi regime is taking advantage of this, right? And they have, pulled away from letting anybody come from different countries in the world.
This year, only 60,000 vaccinated residents of the kingdom are expected to take part.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei in his message called on Muslims to resist aggression and wickedness of Western powers. Ayatollah Khamenei described resistance as a key for the Islamic world to make up for the past when they were subject to arrogant powers' interference.
In a message issued on the occasion of the Hajj pilgrimage, leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Khamenei said Muslim nations have been mostly subject to the aggressive Western countries' greed and interference over the past 150 years. The leader said Muslims should now make up for the past and stand firm against aggression and wickedness of the Western powers. The leader said resistance against the United States and other transgressing countries will help Muslims take their faith into their own hands. He urged Muslims to rush to the assistance of their fellows in Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other countries where the U.S. and its cohorts have been interfering for years.
The intervention in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Afghanistan, you know, all these countries that are in the Middle East that are Islamic by nature, that the majority of people there are Muslims, the American intervention in their hands are in there, and it caused a lot of sedition, a lot of divisions, a lot of problems. And now a lot of countries are suffering economically because the resources are not being used towards liberating their lands and to be more sovereign. And we have puppets that are working in all different countries, unfortunately serving the great Satan, America.
The leader said resistance fighters are eloquently expressing their firm decision to confront every act of interference and malice on the part of the U.S. and its cohorts. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. seeks to distort the will, demands, and actions of resistance forces in the region. He stressed that such efforts stem from America's deep ignorance about awake and alert regional nations. Ayatollah Khamenei concluded that the primary result of a struggle in the way of God will be to prevent America and other international aggressors from interfering in the affairs of Islamic countries.
Moving on, divisions deepen within the European Union over claims that several of the bloc's member states continue to flout the rule of law. Poland and Hungary have been singled out for particular criticism in the European Commission's annual rule of law report. Press TV's Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, are on a collision course. The Commission is demanding that Warsaw adheres to a recent EU Court of Justice ruling that Poland's disciplinary procedure for judges violates EU law.
We will ask for financial sanctions if Poland does not remedy the situation by the 16th of August. Let me repeat that we have said many times, EU law has primacy over national law.
The Commission has just published its 2021 EU Rule of Law report. It highlights concerns surrounding justice systems and corruption. The Commission says it's examining allegations that EU member Hungary has used spyware to hack into the phones of those criticizing Viktor Orban's government.
We will use all the possible tools to receive more information on this. So, of course, at the internal level with the different services of the Commission, we are starting, you mentioned, investigations. We are starting to collect information.
Other EU countries criticized in the Rule of Law report include Bulgaria, Croatia, and Slovenia. Recently, Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša participated in the annual conference of the MKO terrorist organization, sometimes referred to as the MEK. The terrorist group wants to oust the democratically elected government in Iran. Via Skype, former Portuguese MEP Ana Gomes says that the group is mainly funded by Saudi Arabia and Israel.
and it pays people to participate in their events. So my question is, how much has Prime Minister Janssen been paid by MEK?
Critics say the EU is quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations over alleged rule of law breaches, but is very slow to take action when some of its own 27 member states flout basic standards. The Commission's annual rule of law report repeatedly highlights the importance of media freedom. It's ironic because the EU's closest ally, the United States, continues to block .com media outlets operated from Iran, including PressTV.com. However, people can still log on using PressTV.ir. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The UK says it will permanently deploy two warships to disputed waters in the South China Sea amid growing tensions between Beijing and the West. During a joint announcement with Japanese counterpart, British Defense Minister Ben Wallace said the deployment will take place later this year. Wallace added that Britain will also sail a carrier strike group through the Chinese-claimed waters in September. China and a number of other Asian countries, including Vietnam and the Philippines, lay overlapping claims on the strategic waterway. In the past months, tensions have flared between Beijing and the West over the issue. Investigative journalist Tony Gossing believes that the UK is deliberately pursuing a confrontational and provocative policy toward China.
The idea of projecting British power over to the South China Sea is very much like the Chinese sailing battleships, aircraft carriers up and down the River Thames. It's not really, the idea is not to be friendly to your foreign power. It's actually quite a provocative thing to do. The British, I think, are just simply part of the US strategy to have a confrontation with China. If anyone remembers about 3 years ago, John Pilger came out with a brilliant documentary, maybe 4 years ago actually, called The Coming War on China. And his prognosis, I think, was absolutely spot on. Brilliant journalist, hardly ever seen or heard in the Western press at all, even though he's one of the greatest journalists there's ever been. And The Coming War on China explains that the West, it looks like it's losing the economic war, and so it's going to go towards a much more provocative potential shooting war in order to try and intimidate China.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The intensity and scale of the floods in Germany this week have shocked climate scientists, who did not expect records to be broken this much over such a wide area or this soon. After the deadly heatwave in the United States and Canada, where temperatures rose above 49.6 degrees Celsius 2 weeks ago, the deluge in Central Europe has raised fears that human-caused climate disruption is making extreme weather even worse than predicted. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Jonathan Watts. The piece is titled, Climate Scientists Shocked by Scale of Floods in Germany. Intensity and scale of the floods in Germany this week have shocked climate scientists who did not expect records to be broken this much and over such a wide area or this soon. After a deadly heat wave in western United States and Canada, where temperatures rose above 49.6 degrees Celsius 2 weeks ago, the deluge in Central Europe has raised fears that human-caused climate disruption is making extreme weather even worse than predicted. Precipitation records were smashed across a wide area of the Rhine Basin on Wednesday, with devastating consequences. At least 170 people have been killed, tens of thousands of homes have been flooded, and power supplies disrupted. Parts of Rhineland-Palatinate and North Rhine-Westphalia were inundated with 148 liters of rain per square meter within 48 hours. In a part of Germany that usually sees about 80 litres of rain in the whole month of July. The city of Hagen declared a state of emergency after the Volme River burst its banks and its waters rose to levels not seen more than four times a century. The most striking of more than a dozen records was set at the Korn-Stamheim station, which was deluged in 154 millimetres of rain over 24 hours. Obliterating the city's previous daily rainfall high of 95 millimeters. Climate scientists have long predicted that human emissions would cause more floods, more heat waves, more droughts, storms, and other forms of extreme weather, but the latest spikes have surpassed many expectations. I'm surprised by how far it is above the previous record, Dieter Gerten, professor of global change and climatology and hydrology at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, said, "We seem to be not just above normal, but in domains we didn't expect in terms of spatial extent and the speed it developed." Professor Dieter Gerten, who grew up in a village in the affected area, said, "It occasionally flooded, but not like this, but not like this week. Previous summer downpours have been as heavy, but have hit a smaller area, and previous winter storms have not raised rivers to such dangerous levels. This week's event is totally untypical for the region. It lasted a long time and affected a very wide area," he said. Scientists will need more time to assess the extent to which human emissions made the storm more likely, but the record downpour is in keeping with the broader global trends. With climate change, we do expect all hydro-meteorological extremes to become more extreme. What we have seen in Germany is broadly consistent with this trend, said Carlo Buentempo, the director of the Copernicus Climate Change Service at the European Centre for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts. The seven hottest years in recorded history have all occurred since 2014. Largely as a result of global heating, which is caused by engine exhaust fumes, forest burning, and other human activities. Computer models predict this will cause more extreme weather, which means records will be broken again, with more frequency in more places. The Americas have been the focus in recent weeks. The Canadian national daily heat record was exceeded by more than 5 degrees Celsius 2 weeks ago, as were several local records in Oregon and in Washington state. Scientists said these extremes at such latitudes were virtually impossible without human-driven warming. Last weekend, the monitoring station at Death Valley in California registered 54.4 degrees Celsius, which could prove to be the highest reliably recorded temperature on Earth. Daniel Swain, a climate scientist at the University of California in Los Angeles, said so many records were being set in the United States this summer that they no longer made the news. The extremes that would have been newsworthy just a couple of years ago aren't, because they pale in comparison to the astonishing rises a few weeks ago. This was happening in other countries too, he said, though with less media attention. The United States is often in the spotlight, but we have also seen extraordinary heat events in Northern Europe and also in Siberia. This is not a localized freak event, it is definitely part of a coherent global pattern. The far north of Europe also sweltered in record-breaking temperatures in June, and cities in India, Pakistan, and Libya have endured unusually high temperatures in recent weeks. Suburbs of Tokyo, Japan have been drenched in the heaviest rainfall since measurements began, and a usual month's worth of July rain fell in London in just one day. Events that were once in 100 years are becoming commonplace. Freak weather is increasingly normal. Some experts fear the recent jolts indicate the climate system may have crossed a dangerous threshold. Instead of smoothly rising temperatures and steadily increasing extremes, they're examining whether the trend may be increasingly non-linear or bumpy as a result of knock-on effects from drought or ice melt in the Arctic. This theory is contentious because recent events have prompted more discussion about this possibility and the reliability of models based on past observations. We need to better model nonlinear events, said Professor Girton. We scientists in recent years have been surprised by some events that occurred earlier and were more frequent and more intense than expected.
The Spotlight.
Washington has accused Beijing of hacking Microsoft. This time, the U.S. is not alone in blaming China. The Biden administration has organized a number of allies to condemn Beijing for cyber attacks around the world. China has responded by blaming the U.S. for global eavesdropping. Now, Beijing saying it's a major victim of cyber attacks. It alludes to tens of thousands of overseas malware servers, many of them in NATO countries, attacking millions of Chinese computer hosts. Now, what's the goal of this digital software that the West has launched against China? How far could it go, and what would that entail?
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the U.S. and some of its Western allies, including the U.K., have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese Foreign Ministry slamming that quote fabricated allegation.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept.
For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the U.S. administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy two warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the U.S. and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe. That was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of seven wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. U.S. President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached to the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington see as a threat to its global hegemony.
All right, that was a report by Mehdi Farman. Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behrouz Najafi, and we're discussing the blame game that the West has waged against China. Joining me in tonight's show will be author and journalist Daniel Lazar in New York. From the Asia desk of the Executive Intelligence Review, Mike Billington in Leesburg, Virginia. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's start with Daniel. The U.S. is accusing China of cyber attacks, and China is responding by accusing the U.S. of indiscriminate eavesdropping across the world. So what's going on?
Well, it seems that the U.S. is ramping up its campaign against China. This campaign is growing more and more intense under the Biden administration. Whose whole raison d'etre, whose whole reason for existence is to essentially restore U.S. hegemony around the globe after the setbacks, what Democrats see as the setbacks during the Trump years. So that means a stepped up pressure on Russia and stepped up pressure on China as well. And certainly the latest allegations about cyber attacks is part of that campaign. The Europeans echoed the charges that China has allowed its territory to be used for cyber attacks. The Europeans did not intentionally separated themselves from U.S. allegations that the Chinese intelligence agencies are behind the attacks. The U.S. has offered no evidence for that. The charges are highly explosive if they were true. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. credibility, which has suffered tremendously over the last 20 years, takes another blow when the U.S. makes unwarranted, unsubstantiated allegations like this. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. is on the warpath. It's trying to push China back. China is refusing to budge. And some kind of significant confrontation seems to be taking place between the U.S. and China. We don't know what form that confrontation will take, but there's every reason to think that the confrontation is intensifying, that it'll reach some kind of climax in the coming period, and that it's extremely dangerous, not only for the two countries involved, the U.S. and China, but for the globe in general. We do not want a military conflict between the U.S. and China, two nuclear powers with immense military capabilities.
Now, Mike, American officials say that this diplomatic goal behind this concerted move is to make China and Russia agree to a set of guardrails for behavior, maybe an accord on what targets and behavior would be prohibited. Is that really the main goal?
Rules-based order, right? The rules-based order that you hear all the time from the British and the U.S. is simply a phrase which says we do not follow international law anymore. We set the rules, and you must follow our rules. Remember, there are international laws. They were established by the UN after the war. All of those laws demonstrate quite clearly that every one of the U.S. and British regime change invasions was a wild violation of international law, whereas Russia and China have done no such thing. But I want to make one correction to your initial statement, and I understand why, because it's always conveyed this way in the media, but this was not initiated by the U.S. Typically, this was initiated by the British, and they dragged the U.S. along to do their bidding on their view that the British are the brains with the dumb giant America doing their bidding for colonial wars and so forth, as in Iraq and Libya and Syria. And it's the same thing here. This was, in this case, the British even acknowledged that they were the author. The GCHQ, which is the center of their intelligence, the NSA equivalent, put out a statement today with the National Cybersecurity Center, which is part of that institution, which just read straight out, quote, the UK has revealed that Chinese state-backed actors were responsible for gaining access to computer networks around the world via Microsoft Exchange servers. And they go on to say that this is the most significant widespread cyber and so on and so forth. But as usual, like with Tony Blair saying it is very likely that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, this statement is full of almost certain, highly likely, or even just likely. And as Mr. Lazar said, Joseph Borrell from the EU did not say that this was Chinese state supported. They say these are people who may have been in China. But the British and the dumb giant in the United States is going along with that. The second thing I'd correct is that you have to look at, you cannot look at the U.S. as a single voice, even with the Biden administration. I'm sure you remember that under Trump, he talked about being friends with Russia, friends with China, ending the regime change wars, and none of that happened because the military-industrial complex has a greater power and Wall Street over than the presidency. And that's still true. You cannot ignore the fact that Biden, despite what Tony Blinken and the State Department are saying, had a meeting with Vladimir Putin, had an almost four-hour phone call with Vladimir Putin, and on this case as well, he said, we don't think this was the Chinese state, but we think it was Chinese actors. So the whole thing is hokum, as usual, like most highly likely and so forth, and it is very dangerous. There's no question about that. But I think we have to think in terms of how to get around this insanity and to bring about a higher ordered agreement. And I will go on in the next segment if you wish, but what's happening in Afghanistan indicates precisely the location of where we can, in fact, bring Russia and China and the United States together. And I'd be glad to discuss that.
Okay. Now, Daniel, no sanctions were announced against China on Monday. That's in sharp contrast to what the penalties of Washington imposed on Moscow in April over solar wind attacks that allegedly affected the U.S. government agencies and 100 firms. Why no sanctions or penalties this time?
Well, the U.S. is highly dependent on China at this point. I mean, China holds large amounts of U.S. Treasury securities, which, and if they were to dump those, if they got sufficiently angry at Washington and dump those securities, the result would be economic turmoil. China is also a major supplier of manufactured goods for the U.S., and the U.S. really can't afford to have an open trade war, so therefore it's treading somewhat lightly. And I also think it's very possible that the Biden administration doesn't really have full confidence in these findings. The idea that it's the Chinese intelligence agencies which are behind these attacks, I mean, that's a real stretch. And to impose sanctions on the basis of that assertion alone, which could have dramatic economic consequences, is maybe just a step too far for the Biden administration. So this is all to the good that the administration is treading somewhat cautiously, but nonetheless, they're pushing, or they are being pushed by forces behind the scenes. And there's no doubt that some kind of confrontation is brewing. And that is extremely dangerous.
Okay. And, Mike, you know, as U.S. is pushing this, China is responding by saying that it was the U.S. that engaged in large-scale organized and indiscriminate cyber intrusion, and citing the 2013 revelations by Edward Snowden that set off a debate about government surveillance. Let's have your take on that.
It wasn't a debate. It was an exposure of the fact that the U.S. is basically a police state and surveils everybody in the world. So that's known. That's not a surprise. The Chinese are absolutely right. But look, it's very important to look what's just happened in Afghanistan. You know, the U.S. pulled out rather precipitously, and there's many, many people saying, oh, this could be a disaster. You could have a return of terrorism and drugs. But the U.S. attended a meeting in Uzbekistan this last week. Khalilzad was there, and the advisor to Biden on Homeland Security, Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, was also there, and signed an agreement with Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Uzbekistan, which explicitly said that we want to back the building of infrastructure and transit, building transit links, which is the program being pursued by the Chinese and the Russians for the last 10 years, to make Afghanistan once again the hub for the new Silk Road, for the Belt and Road program, rather than the graveyard of empires, as it's been known since the British-Russian Great Game. And this is very, very serious. It may not work. I'm not being Pollyanna about this, but the fact that the U.S. government itself said that China could play a very positive role in the rebuilding of Afghanistan, and that at least officially we're signing documents which the SCO, as well as this special grouping that was meeting in Tashkent this last week, are committed to dealing with this pullout by the U.S. as an opportunity. And of course, you know, the U.S. is there for 20 years. We obviously failed miserably. We achieved nothing except horror and chaos and massive drug production. So good, they're out. But you don't want them to get out in a way which turns into another, you know, uncontrolled terror drug output. Remember, Afghanistan produces 80% of the world's opium.
Right.
So now we have the potential of the U.S. and Joe Biden, who, despite all of his horrible problems and his early stage dementia, is an old-style Democrat who obviously believes that there should be face-to-face diplomacy with Vladimir Putin, which he's carried out, and which he has hinted, and people around him whom we're in touch with indicate that he also wants such an agreement with Xi Jinping. This is absolutely crucial to get Russia and China and the U.S. to sit down together and to override, basically, the British and the U.S. intelligence circles, the Wall Street crowd, and the military-industrial complex. Is that a big ticket? That's a huge ticket. Is it possible? It's possible precisely because we're watching the greatest breakdown of civilization in modern history, the breakdown of the financial system, which is now completely out of control and going into hyperinflation, the threat of a nuclear war, this Green New Deal insanity, which is trying to shut down industrial development and impose virtual genocide in the third world. And there is a flashback to this. People are beginning to react against the insanity of a world gone nuts and want to see a higher order principle based on peace through development, okay, the message that Lyndon LaRouche has been arguing for the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, let's look at Europe. Europe has lucrative business with China, as you know, and it's been unwilling to criticize the country in the past, but this time it's done that, and it's done that publicly, of course, without mentioning directly China. Is this a change of heart or what?
Well, I think Europe is trying to straddle the difference. I mean, Europe doesn't want a war, obviously, with the exception of Boris Johnson's Britain. It wants to tread very carefully. It wants to do business. It wants to maintain international comity and good relations. So the Europeans' response to this latest U.S. Move was very careful. They agreed, they backed the U.S. when it came to charges that these attacks are emanating out of China. But they refused to go along with the Biden administration's accusation that Chinese state intelligence agencies are involved. And that's a very important distinction. So they want to maintain the integrity of the internet. They want to stop criminal abuses of this sort, but they don't want to engage in this kind of global imperialist madness that the U.S. Is pushing. And I think that as I said before, I mean, Biden's whole raison d'etre is to restore the global hegemony that the U.S. exercised prior to Trump, but he can't do it. The U.S. is losing power dramatically. Its defeat in Afghanistan is the most dramatic example recently. But the U.S. is grossly overextended. Its empire lacks a rationale. There's no rational basis for it. But yet the Biden administration is pushing in order to restore the status quo ante. And this is very dangerous because it won't be able to do so. And the danger is that it will overreach and blunder into some kind of military confrontation. And the U.S. has a lengthy example of these kinds of reckless, careless actions. And the chances are very high it'll do this. It's doing the same thing again in the South China Sea and other conflict zones.
Now, Mike, China featured prominently in the G7 communique that was held recently. The group of seven wealthy nations are planning to set up an infrastructure to compete with China's massive Belt and Road Initiative. So what would that mean for the global economy?
Well, I wish they would compete with the Belt and Road by starting to invest in infrastructure around the world, which the U.S. has not done for about 35 or 40 years now. That's not what they meant by that. This was an effort to stop the Belt and Road by declaring the Belt and Road to be an imperialist trick. They're trying to take over the world. They are diplomatically threatening countries like El Salvador, like Argentina, like African countries, threatening them that if they do proceed with accepting Chinese investments in infrastructure and development, which is the one hope they have of getting out of poverty and becoming modern nations, and they're being threatened that if they proceed with this, they're going to be punished with sanctions, with cutoff of credit, and so forth. Let me make one important point again.
Sure.
David's right that Biden has, by and large, gone along with what the military-industrial complex says, as Trump ended up doing as well. But it's important that he, like I said, he is distinguishing himself from the Tony Blinkens, who's just another Mike Pompeo, by having these meetings with Russia and potentially with China. And on this issue, he, like the EU, said, our intelligence says that this was done in China, but there's no indication that this was done by the Chinese government. And this is, it might seem small, but this is important. And with this going on in Afghanistan, the potential over these next days for some significant coming together around a reconstruction program for Afghanistan, this is not only important for Central Asia, this is important for the world. The Iraqis are looking at this very, very closely. The Syrians are looking at this as a basis for saying, let's get the U.S. troops out and let's bring in the Belt and Road and development. And there's a hint, at least, a hint that the U.S. could go along with that, which would be a real phase change, which is what my organization is fighting to make happen here by bringing into play these international forces who are trying to bring about a sane resolution to this global breakdown crisis.
Okay, we have only 1 minute left, Daniel. The more sanctions and pressure the U.S. is piling under different pretexts, the closer China and Russia are getting together. They're approaching countries for cooperation. Let's have your comment.
Well, I think what's happening is the more the U.S. Efforts in this regard are counterproductive. The more it pushes, the more it only succeeds in uniting a variety of countries against its own power grab. So China, Russia, Japan, China, Russia, and Iran are the best examples of this. They are being forced. They're highly disparate countries. They believe different things. They have different backgrounds. But they are being forced into a union because due to opposition to the lawless behavior by the United States, the lawless bullying behavior by the United States. And the more the United States pushes in this regard, the more Russia, China, and Iran are forced to cooperate and to form an alliance against this very aggressive, these aggressive moves emanating out of Washington.
Okay, got to jump in. We're out of time. Thank you very much for your comments. Author and journalist Daniel Lazar in New York, and from the Asia Desk of the Executive Intelligence Review, we had Mike Billington from Leesburg, Virginia. And that's it for this edition of The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behruz Najar.
Eid al-Adha, or Feast of the Sacrifice, is a major Islamic holiday celebrating the willingness of Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, to sacrifice his firstborn son Ishmael as an act of obedience to God's command. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, the Feast of Sacrifice. Eid Mubarak.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear brothers and sisters. Eid Mubarak. We'd like to congratulate all the Muslims around the world, for these are the days of the celebration of the Day of Sacrifice in the Hijjah, the holy month of pilgrimage for Muslim followers. With me today is my brother, Sheikh Muhammad. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Eid Mubarak.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you so very much for having me again. Thank God for this blessing again. We have felt this day and this very happy day again. We are having this honor to be able to talk about the good characteristics of this day.
It is very happy day for Muslims around the world. Make us happy. What do you have today? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I think talking about this the day of sacrifice. We should know more, and we should talk about the roots of this day. You know, sacrificing for God is the thing that actually happened in the story of the Prophet Ibrahim, which God commanded him to sacrifice his son. And God wanted to test him. Does he obey God even in these
his
situations?
Belief, to see
yes.
How hard his belief is.
Yes. How obedient is he? I think the first thing that we should talk about here is the matter of obedience, is the matter of servitude of God, right? What is it based on? Is it based on knowledge, or is it based on, you know, foolishness? What is it based on? Probably some people might ask that, you know, what is the difference between blindly following somebody and the difference between servitude of God? Why do you so much talk about pleasing God? You know,
being servants of Allah.
Servants of Allah. I want to be a good servant. I'm doing this in service of Allah. I'm doing this to please Allah, for example. I'm not doing that because of Allah. These are the normal sentences which Muslim people say, and other people might have difficulty understanding them. And even within the Muslim society...
Non-religious people, yeah.
Yes, altogether. Non-religious people. And even within the Muslim society, the meaning has not been so much researched about.
Especially for those who are not devoted in their followings. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And you can see the reflect of that in their actions. I think studying about this meaning of servitude, which has been so much talked about in the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, even in the Book of God, in Quran, that God Himself says, "Ma khalaqtul jinna wal insa illa liya'budun." I have created jinns. I have created human and jinns only to serve me, only to worship me. What is the meaning of this worshiping and serving God? I think it comes back to the knowledge that we have, the introduction that God has made of Himself to us in previous worlds. You know, when studying Quran and also after that the narrations, we find that before this world has existed some other worlds. And in those worlds, God has introduced Himself to us completely. We know Him. For instance, in Quran, after describing this occurrence, God says, "Alastu rabbukum?" "Qalu bala."
God says, "Am I not your Lord?"
Yes,
they say, "Yes."
Am I not your Lord? All of them said, "Yes." To interpret these, we go to the sayings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. For instance, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that this is about the alam of that, about another world.
Another world
that God has introduced Himself clearly to His creations. Now, when we say introducing, we do not mean that God kind of showed Himself or them, because God is not like doesn't
bestowed
have
knowledge
body,
upon them.
Nothing. Yeah, by heart, you can know God. You can even, you know, understand very much know God, right? Like see Him even in your heart. What does it mean by seeing? For instance, a person comes to Amir al-Mu'min sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and says, "Do you know the Lord that you worship?
Or have you not seen the Lord
yes.
that you worship? Ara'ayta Rabbak?"
Ara'ayta Rabbak. And Amir al-Mu'min sallallahu alayhi wa says, "I do not worship a God that I have not seen." And that person says, "How is it?" Amir al-Mu'min sallallahu alayhi says, "Bihaqaq al-Iman." I have seen Him by my heart, by my faith, my deep beliefs in God, I have seen Him. So it means when your faith and beliefs grow and grow, the bigger and deeper, you will know God more. It's as if you have seen Him, right? So this occurrence has happened. And the creation, the human beings, they know they have been completely introduced to God. And so they have accepted that this is our Lord, this is God. It's not a fun thing, it's not a silly thing. No, it's serious, it is God. And we all accept to be His servants. So after this, we come to this world. We pick a religion. God actually describes and tells people about the religion that He has. And people understand about this religion. And one important thing that God wants them to do is to serve Him. Now, I would like to say that this serving is based on the knowledge that we have had. Now, what kind of knowledge? We will explain.
Inshallah ta'ala, after the break. Thank you very much, Sheikhna. Brothers and sisters, please stay tuned. We'll talk about the knowledge, or that precise knowledge that the Sheikh was talking about when we return. We'd like to congratulate all the Muslims around the world. Eid Mubarak. Light upon light.
Eid al-Sa'id, let's enjoy this happy day. Eid al-Mubarak, come on, let's celebrate. Eid al-Sa'id, let's enjoy this happy day. Eid al-Mubarak, come on, let's celebrate. Celebrate, let's celebrate. Allah, Allah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters, from our short break. Thank you for tuning in. Light upon light. We are with our brother, Sheikh Muhammad, talking about these happy days, the days of Eid al-Fitr.